from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
I'm sure you've all heard the big news that we're going to work on the CAFE standards so you can make cars in America again.
That was President Trump a few weeks ago telling auto workers that he plans to get rid of some fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. And that has people worrying about the electric vehicle industry, which some say is dependent on regulation. But with Tesla briefly overtaking General Motors yesterday as the most valuable automaker in America, according to Wall Street, it looks like the industry might be moving forward, regulations or not. The future of the electric car is next on Forum after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Electric vehicles, or EVs, have been around for over a century, and despite being especially popular here in the Bay Area, they've never quite cracked the national market. But with Palo Alto-based Tesla momentarily overtaking General Motors as the most valuable car company in America, announced just yesterday, and their more affordable Model 3 set to be released within the next year, electric vehicles might be headed down the road to the mainstream. But as the Trump administration plans to roll back emission standards for cars and trucks, some people are worried that an industry reliant on regulation might be in for an uneasy future. This hour of Forum, we talk with some experts about the current state of electric cars in the United States, and we discuss how President Trump's policies on energy and trade might affect the electric car industry. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. We want to welcome here in studio Ethan Elkind. He's director of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Joel Levin, who joins us this morning from Culver City, executive director of Plug-in America. Joel Levin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And also have Lauren McDonald with us from Las Vegas, marketing and electronic vehicle evangelist, author of the forthcoming book, Gas Station Zero. We welcome you to the program, Lauren McDonald.
Great. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. And let me begin with you, because probably you may be one of the, as an evangelist, one of the most passionate voices in favor of electronic vehicles. And I know you're pretty much not only completely on board, but feel that even though we're only at 1% here in the United States, 4% in California, Holland's at 40%. How are we going to get those numbers higher? You seem to feel they're inevitable and destined.
Yeah, it's a matter of time, and really sort of what I like to say is five factors I call karma, which is really fundamentally we've got to get there from sort of the charging infrastructure and the time it takes to charge. So one of the things that inhibits people from going electric today is they're worried about it taking, you know, an hour to charge their car when they're driving down Interstate 5 or whatever. We're going to get there in the next 5 or 7 years. We need more affordable cars. We need more models. I like to say, you know, when we get to the point where a family can walk into a Ford dealer and have their choice of, you know, half a dozen pickups and SUVs and stuff, we will have arrived. And
that's a big hindrance. You don't have the SUVs, right? At this
right.
Point.
I mean, well, we've got a couple that are plug-in hybrids, and we've got obviously the Tesla Model X, but those tend to be, you know, on the expensive end, right? $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000. And so there's several in the works that are coming out. The Tesla Model Y is supposed to come out in about 3 years, which will be again in about that $40,000 range. But yeah, I mean, there's you know, sort of availability, and ultimately, I know Joel is passionate about kind of the awareness part of that, and I really see that is as much awareness as understanding of the role and value of electric cars.
Yeah, Joel Levin, from your perspective, it's really all about, as we just heard from Lauren McDonald, people knowing what's out there and understanding what's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. For Plug-in America, one thing that we're always talking about is that electric vehicles, electric drive, it's a fundamentally better technology than the internal combustion engine, and I think that's kind of a secret that people don't generally realize. As you mentioned, they've been around for 100 years. Electric cars were around before the Model T, and it's a very simple, elegant technology. I mean, at its core, electric drive is basically like a fancy ceiling fan. There's so many parts that are required to make a gasoline car go that you don't need with an electric car. There's no spark plugs, no oil, no engine, no radiators. So it's a very simple, elegant technology. So very low maintenance, as you can imagine, because there's a lot fewer parts to break. They're a lot more fun to drive, as you can find out if you ask any EV driver. They're more powerful. You step on the pedal and they really go. They're cheaper to fuel. They're convenient because every morning you wake up and your car is fully charged. And of course, they're good for the environment because electric cars have no tailpipe. And I think people don't realize that just across the board, it's a more attractive technology because it's really been masked by the limitations of battery technology for a long time. The batteries and the range were always this big problem that people couldn't get past. But battery technology is changing now very rapidly. And so that's very exciting. And so I think you're going to see people kind of getting past that as we're moving from the current generation of cars that mostly get around 100 miles of range per charge, you know, minus the Tesla, obviously, which is more expensive, to a new generation that's going to be getting 200 plus miles per range. And that's happening very quickly, starting with the Bolt EV that has just come out and a number of other cars coming out in the next couple of years, so that pretty soon I think you'll see a much longer range on these cars and people's fears about running out of charge are going to start to go away.
And the battery technology is moving forward and certainly taking some leaps in terms of progress. You just did a very nice, succinct advocacy for why electric cars are important or ought to be more important in terms of people's awareness, because I know your biggest concern you have or the biggest challenge is the unawareness of the convenience and lower maintenance and things that you mentioned, not to mention environmental factors. More power, though? A lot of people raise their eyebrows and say, how does it have more power?
Go drive one or talk to someone who drives one. One of the sort of secrets of Plug in America, how we survive, is that the drivers are very, very passionate about these cars. People get in these cars, drive them, and they think, wow, this is great. And they want to share their stories with people because you step on the accelerator and the cars really go. It's not just the Tesla. It's all of the electric cars.
Let me go to Ethan Elkind, who again is with us in studio and directs the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. And I want to talk with you specifically, Ethan, about climate change and about environmental effect of electronic vehicles. But let's talk first about the effect of some of these Trump administration actions that have already taken place and are probably inevitably going to take place.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Trump administration has injected some uncertainty into the landscape, and electric vehicles were really heavily supported by public policy for many years, and I think they're just now getting to the point where the market can really take hold. But the federal government, just as one critical example, provides a $7,500 tax credit if you buy or lease an electric vehicle. You have to lease over a certain number of years to qualify for it. So that's an important stimulus for people to buy. And then on top of that, the Obama administration negotiated pretty strict fuel economy standards for automakers that are locked in for the coming decades. But there are some mid-process reviews that the Trump administration has now said it wants to undertake, which would, you know, presumably weaken these federal fuel economy standards. And, you know, while the fuel economy standards have to do with gas engines, one of the ways the automakers can comply is by coming up with and investing in electric vehicles.
So, necessarily have the incentive to do that, though, if the regulations aren't there.
So I think they do because of a lot of the reasons that Joel and Lauren just talked about, which is that, you know, the market is heading in this direction. Batteries are getting cheaper, and I think a lot of automakers do see the writing on the wall. But part of it is the flip side of what Joel just talked about. When you don't have all those spark plugs and other parts that go into an internal combustion engine, automakers are heavily invested in that technology. And so it's a hard thing for them to step away from that internal combustion engine research and engineering skills that they built up over a century. So I think there's reluctance on their part. But it's also important to keep in mind that California has very aggressive policies on electric vehicles, which has really helped drive the market, no pun intended. And that's because we're a huge market here. And other states are able to sign on through the Clean Air Act to what California is doing in terms of mandating automakers to have a certain percentage of zero-emission vehicles in their fleets or have to buy credits if they don't produce it themselves. So we have very aggressive policies, even if the Trump administration were to roll back on some of the support.
And the Trump administration is about to extend the number of auto jobs, too, which is part of this equation. But I just wonder about the fact that there's concern about the oil market in all this, isn't there?
Well, the oil industry, I think, is not really taking electric vehicles as seriously as they probably should. But if you look at the long term in terms of just increasing fuel economy and this trend towards battery electrics, I think they're going to be seeing declining market share, not in the near term. I think they've got another decade or so to really pump a lot of oil and unfortunately create a lot more pollution. But as battery prices come way down, I think it's really going to be a game changer. And just as an example, when I first started looking at battery technologies in 2010, the cost of a battery was about $1,000 a kilowatt hour. It's now gone to what I've heard, $165 a kilowatt hour. So a massive decrease with the Chevy Bolt EV. And as those trends continue, it's going to be really hard to continue business as usual for the oil and gas industry and automakers with their internal combustion engines.
Well, speaking of trends, and this may just be an opinion that one cannot necessarily come to with the, you have a feeling that it's not a feeling. I mean, there's a really concerted support for the opinion that this is an administration that really doesn't give much concern about climate change. And there was a definite trend among Americans wanting to do something about climate change because of the emphasis of the Obama administration, not trying to put partisan politics here, but you know, the Trump administration has been less, shall we say, less supportive, and that's got to affect things, doesn't it?
I mean, I see the Trump administration as less about being sort of anti-climate change and more about trying to protect the oil and gas industry, because they are certainly picking winners and losers when it comes to our energy supply, given what they're doing with regulations. And it is true that they've been hostile to climate change. Trump and his campaign rhetoric has been hostile to the science underlying climate change. And this is a crucial technology for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. There's no doubt about it. At 40% here in California of our greenhouse gas emissions comes from driving. So if we cannot switch to cleaner fuels, we're not going to be able to achieve our long-term goals. And fortunately, you know, as we've been talking about, electric vehicles present a really viable, attractive option as a different fuel source for driving. So there's going to be a limit to what the Trump administration can do as they try to roll back some of these policies. And meanwhile, you're going to see states and even cities step up. We just saw a whole gathering of large cities agree to buy fleets of electric vehicles. That's a huge amount of purchasing power there. So as a federal government sort of takes a step back, puts a pause on their efforts to combat climate change, you're going to see a lot of states and cities step up. And as you mentioned, Holland, other countries, China's investing in this technology. So there's still a lot of investment that's happening all around the world, even with the Trump administration putting
things on pause. And California has stepped up. In fact, playing right off of what we just heard from Ethan Elkind, Joel Levin, if I could go back to you, there are 30 different electric vehicles in California. There's also a 2025 target of 15% of electric vehicle new car sales. And the California bill is exempt from the sales tax, yeah?
Yes, that's right. So California has its own aggressive standards, and we have a commitment to 1.5 million vehicles by 2025. And I think we're actually kind of on a glide path to get there. I mean, it won't be easy. Glide path's maybe a little generous, but it's definitely achievable. And so California is pushing very hard to get the vehicles out. There's a whole range of different initiatives that the state has taken, and we think that they're well on their way to getting there.
But we are at this point. You were talking before about travel range currently and battery technology moving forward, like we heard from Ethan Elkind and so forth. It's still somewhat more expensive than gas cars, isn't it, overall?
No, I wouldn't say that. No? If you look at the total cost of ownership, that includes the federal tax credit, the state rebate, different benefits that utilities give you, the savings in fueling, because buying electricity is much cheaper than buying gasoline, and then the savings in maintenance overall over the life of the car, and you're comparing apples to apples. So when you look at a certain style of car, you're looking at the equivalent gasoline car. No, it's not more expensive. It's probably a little bit cheaper.
Did you want to say something here, Ethan, about cost?
Well,
Ethan,
yeah. I mean, most of the cost is the battery. So for a Nissan Leaf, for example, $30,000 car, maybe $15,000, $20,000 of that is the battery. So the car itself is actually very inexpensive, maybe $10,000 to $12,000 for just the sort of basic vehicle. So it gives a lot of room for much bigger battery capacity going forward. So I think in the long term, you're going to see these cars be very inexpensive and have really significant range.
And again, yeah, Ethan Elkind is director of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. Lauren McDonald, you want in here?
I just wanted to add, going back to the battery prices, most of the experts predict that in about the next 5 years, that price that Ethan talked about is going to get down to about $100 per kilowatt hour or less, meaning that the cost to produce an electric car will actually be at about the same to produce an internal combustion engine. And that's really sort of the critical point, right, where the main thing that's holding people from buying these cars back is, even though as Joel talked about, sort of over the life of the car, it's cheaper. If you walk into a dealer and look at the sticker price, right, it's still significantly more. You can reduce that with all of those credits and things like that, but somebody still has to sort of get a bank loan, et cetera, at that price. So we've got to get that price down to where it doesn't become a factor anymore, and that's going to be in about 5 years. At that same time, the average range of electric cars is going to go from, you know, what we see, a lot of them are around 100, to then up to the Tesla and Bolt at over 200. The average range is going to probably be at about that 250 miles. And then it's probably game over.
Well, your thinking seems to suggest, if I may, Lauren, that it's almost a certainty that it's going to take over because of central issues being ameliorated. I'm talking about price, batteries, changing the infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like to use kind of the idea of where we're at. If you put Tesla to the side, but if you put sort of the rest of the manufacturers aside, we're kind of in that 2002 mobile phone era, right? Remember back when we had Palm Trios and the BlackBerry and stuff like that, and they weren't really a competitive, what we would think of today, smartphone. They had a lot of the functionality and features, but really it was about 5 years later, you know, with the Apple iPhone, when you had the apps and you had the cell connection, everything sort of came together. And I believe I predict that's 2024. It's when those sort of factors of the range, the cost, and the sort of the charging infrastructure and the time it takes to charge comes down. And it's sort of all of those things will coalesce in probably the next 5 to 7 years.
All right, we've got you down for the prediction, Lauren McDonald. But I have to ask you, since you're talking about competition, the Chinese now own Volvo. They could really eclipse us and crush us, couldn't they?
I think if you go back to the conversation with Ethan and stuff around Trump, I think that sort of we're going to, you know, cut off our face despite or whatever that saying is. But, you know, the problem is that the American auto companies have shown over history that they don't change unless they're forced to, whether it's high gas prices, whether it's the Japanese coming in the 60s and 70s, or financial crisis and stuff. And so I think the problem is as we've discussed, if they're not forced to, it's going to be competitors like Tesla and the Chinese that come in, and the Chinese are investing significantly, and I see companies like Geely and BYD as kind of almost Trojan horses. In other words, we don't necessarily know their names here in America, but BYD is building electric buses. Geely owns Volvo. They're going to come in with an SUV in about 2019, and so they're going to enter this market. The South Koreans, Hyundai and Kia, are launching longer range SUVs and stuff. So if you know, the big three auto in America is not kind of kicked in the rear, they're going to get left behind.
But I wonder, Ethan Elkind, if the big three, the Trump administration, as we've said, is planning to roll back emission standards, big three doesn't have to innovate and can, in fact, just stay where they are.
Well, first of all, trying to roll back the emission standards is not that easy. There is a regulatory process, so it's not going to happen right away. And then secondly, they're still going to have to deal with the California market. And as I mentioned, about a dozen other states have signed on to what California mandates, which is a certain increasing percentage of zero-emission vehicles that these automakers have to sell. So they're going to have to keep making these cars for California. We have that sovereignty to require that written into the Clean Air Act. Barring an act of Congress to revoke that sovereignty that California has, that's going to continue going forward. So that's an important market for the automakers.
Isn't there also a scaling back on a lot of the battery research in the Department of Energy?
Well, that's the other way that the Obama administration in particular was very helpful to electric vehicles. The Department of Energy had a lot of research put into, it still does, into battery technologies and also electric vehicle charging. They have an agency called ARPA-E, Advanced Research Projects for Energy, that has really had a remarkable track record investing in sort of early stage battery research, getting these companies through that valley of death. And they've had a real strong success rate, you know, besides some of the negative talking points that Mitt Romney had on the trail back in 2012. So scaling back on that energy research, assuming it happens with budget cuts through Trump, will be detrimental. But like I say, in a lot of ways, the horses have already left the barn on this one.
Yeah, but what's the worst case scenario? If the Trump administration succeeds in stopping or delaying some of these Obama fuel standards for all vehicles, where are we?
Well, the worst case scenario would be an act of Congress to undercut what California can do on climate change in general. But that's pretty unlikely to happen politically. If they do roll back those fuel economy standards, you're going to see California, I hate to say the word retaliate, but basically
secede.
Well, not secede, but in terms of its ability to mandate zero emission vehicle production from automakers, I think they're going to up that requirement. They'll look into other legislative options that they have within their state sovereignty, you know, as being a part of the United States and under the Clean Air Act. Definitely going to see California and other states step up. But so that would be the sort of most likely worst case scenario, though, that the Trump administration is successful at rolling back those standards and also revoking past waivers that the Obama administration granted California to regulate tailpipe emissions for greenhouse gas emissions. But all this stuff's going to take time in the courts.
Let me bring our listeners into this. And in fact, if you have something you'd like to ask or say about well, the big Wall Street embrace of Tesla, or whether American drivers are going to follow and pretty much heed the call of Tesla and these other electric cars. I'd like to hear your thoughts and like to hear also any questions you might have. Let me invite you to join the program now. Our toll-free number is available. That number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, so please feel free to join the program by phone. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We're talking with Ethan Elkind, who's here with us in studio. He directs the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. It used to be called Bolt Hall. Joel Levin is with us by phone from Culver City, Executive Director of Plug In America, and Lauren McDonald is with us from Las Vegas, and he's marketing and electronic vehicle evangelist, author of the forthcoming book, Gas Station Zero. As we come up on our break, let me read a couple of comments that are already coming in. Jeffrey writes, I can't find any information about charging EV from a standalone solar outfit. How can this be done, or how can I find out about it? Can you help him out, Ethan?
Yeah, so in terms of charging stations, this is a big issue because, you know, if you own a house and you've got a garage and dedicated parking, then you're all set. But if you don't, it's a lot more challenging. And 40% of Californians live in apartment buildings. It's higher percentages in places like San Francisco and LA.
Still more challenging, though, to get hydrogen, even though former Governor Schwarzenegger was all for that, you know, as a panacea.
Yeah, hydrogen is a whole other set of infrastructure needs. But there's a website, plugshare.com, that has all the available public charging sites available. And this is an issue the state is grappling with. How do we get more charging infrastructure out there? Because a lot of people who don't have dedicated parking spots with access to electricity are in a tough spot in terms of getting
especially, as you say, in the apartment buildings. Well, we're going to hear from you, our listeners, when we return. Remind you, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Just yesterday, Tesla overtook General Motors as the most valuable car company in America on Wall Street, and their more affordable Model 3 is set to be released. The real question is, will American drivers follow? And we're talking about electric vehicles. EVs are very much in the news now, and hearing from our listeners as well. In fact, hearing some concerns. Let me remind you, Lauren McDonald's with us. He's a marketing electronic vehicle evangelist and has a forthcoming book called Gas Station Zero. Joel Levin, also with us, executive director of Plug In America, and Ethan Elkind here in studio is director of the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley School of Law. Some concerns, and Ethan, let me go to you on this. You hear this a lot, I'm sure. Battery waste. Teresa says, what's the environmental impact of mining raw materials and the waste associated with EV batteries? And not only that, but always environmentalists concerned about batteries in general, what they do to the environment?
Yeah, no, it's a very common question. And the reality is when you look at the life cycle costs of producing the battery in an electric vehicle compared to an internal combustion engine, there's no comparison. It's much better for the environment, to even considering the mining for lithium and the other metals that go into the battery. And then beyond that, the batteries can be reused once they come out of the vehicle. And this is a market that a lot of companies are starting to explore, where, you know, you take the battery out, it's still got some capacity left. You could stack it, store solar, surplus solar energy, for example. And then after that, they always can be recycled. And that's what Tesla is investing in their Gigafactory out in Nevada, which is to recycle the battery. So the environmental footprint of the battery itself should not be a cause for concern if your choice is between an electric vehicle and an internal combustion engine. But of course, we always would rather people walk and bike and take transit if they don't have to drive. But if you have to get a car, there's no doubt the environmental win is with an electric vehicle.
Well, one more environmental related question. There are a number of them. And let me go to one more before we go to our callers. Joseph writes, if not wholly charged by solar, wind, or nuclear, what level of reduction in carbon emission do electric vehicles create? What percentage are being charged by burning coal?
Well, it's here in California, we have a very clean grid. We don't have any coal-fired power, absent down in L.A. They have a few old contracts that are expiring. So in terms of the fuel source, there's no doubt that it's much cleaner to be on electricity, particularly in places like California. In a few places that are entirely coal-dependent for their electricity, like Wyoming, you may be better off from an environmental perspective getting a hybrid rather than an electric vehicle. But as natural gas prices come down, as solar prices have really plummeted, as the grid overall is getting cleaner, in the long term, electric vehicles are a clear win everywhere, but particularly here in California.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me we're going to go to our first caller here in this hour. Mike, that's you. Good morning.
Hi. You started to touch on some of the complex infrastructure concerns in the home, but what about charging structure out of the home? Is the state doing anything to make it so I can drive my kids to Disneyland in an EV?
Yeah. Joe Levin, can I get you to weigh in on that?
Sure. Well, the good news is that charging infrastructure is being developed pretty rapidly. In fact, for most people, the vast majority of all charging happens at home or at work. So it's a little bit of a different paradigm in thinking about fueling your car. It's maybe a bit more like thinking about a cell phone. So with your cell phone, where do you charge it mostly? At home while you're sleeping, or at work while you're sitting at work? So it's unusual that you would take a cell phone to a third destination to charge it. And with a car, it's much the same. There's what's called destination charging, which is, you know, places like Disneyland where you drive there and you charge and then you come back. But by and large, most people do the bulk of their charging at home or at work, or, you know, along highways with fast charging.
Let me bring another caller aboard. And Chris, that's you. Chris, welcome.
Good morning. You're ignoring another kind of electric vehicle. The largest fleet of fuel cell buses in the world is run by AC Transit over in Oakland. We produce 60 kilograms a day with hydrogen, or I'm sorry, with solar power on top of all our buildings. And they refuel, a bus refuels in 6 minutes, a car refuels in 3 minutes. So it becomes pretty much indistinguishable from a polluting internal combustion vehicle. You don't have to worry if you're going to take your kids to Disneyland that you're going to get stuck in Fresno or something.
Thank you for that comment, Chris. You want to respond, Ethan Elkind?
Sure. Well, there are other ways of having clean-fueled vehicles. Battery electric vehicles are not the only one. There is hydrogen fuel cell, and we're using a lot of biofuels in California, too. And for all of our transportation needs, we're probably going to need a mix. But there's no question that battery electrics are going to be probably suitable for, I would guess, something like 90% of the market, just knowing where the price is and the range is. Hydrogen is a little trickier because you have to produce it. That takes energy, so it's less efficient than just going direct electricity to the battery, and you also have to develop that charging infrastructure. And now we're seeing battery electric buses. There's a company, Proterra, just based down the road in Silicon Valley, that's selling electric buses to all sorts of transit agencies.
Actually, hydrogen would be a lot cheaper theoretically. I mean, if you could infrastructure. Yeah.
It depends on how it's produced. I think, you know, bang for your buck, battery electrics are better for the environment overall, just because you have that energy loss when you're converting it to hydrogen. But hydrogen is probably going to be needed for things like long-distance trucking, for example. So, you know, we do need an all-the-above type approach to this, but I think battery is likely to take, you know, most of the market.
I'm going to read a few comments here before we go to more calls. Jeff writes, this seems to harken back to the idea that maybe more EVs are definitely on the way. He says, I put down $1,000 on the day Tesla Model 3 was unveiled, and considering the hundreds of thousands of reservations that have followed, I'd say, yes, there is a tremendous pent-up demand for electric cars, especially ones that don't look like electric shavers. And here's Andrea, who writes, I have owned a Fiat 500e for 3 years now, and I'm an e-vehicle believer. I used to have a Fiat, by the way, and somebody told me it used to stand, it's supposed to stand for Fix It Again, Tony. But anyway, Andrea goes on to write, I originally leased it because of its size, but the acceleration and speed plus the easy charging have made me a convert. I still giggle when I drive past gas stations. Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to Brandon. You're on the air.
Yeah, a quick comment and then a question. I just bought a used 2015 Nissan Leaf, only 19,000 miles, and it only cost me $9,500, which is a pretty remarkable value for a used vehicle. Then my question is, do you guys know of anything about aftermarket battery packs? Because mine only has about 100-mile range, but if they're developing packs that are going to have longer ranges, is there any opportunity to swap out the pack that I have now for a longer-range pack?
Yeah, can you help us, Lauren McDonald?
Yeah, there's. I'm not aware of, unless Joel or somebody else is, of any sort of battery pack swapping in the States. Tesla was looking at doing it about a year and a half ago. They actually sort of developed it, showed it off, but never actually implemented it. In Europe, though, there are some different models where Renault actually does a subscription-based service. So you actually are leasing, in essence, the battery pack. And so I think there's going to be that opportunity in some markets where you could upgrade your battery pack over some time. But it's certainly Tesla's not going that direction unless, you know, somebody else is aware of that.
Well, Joe Levin, any more information that you know of?
No, that's correct. Right now, I mean, there are some aftermarket places that will do it, but it's very expensive because of the cost of batteries. I think that's going to change. I think in a couple of years, you're likely to see more and more of that. Right now, it's not really a great deal.
Well, let me thank Brandon for the call and bring another caller on. Dell, you're on. Morning.
Hi. That last exchange there sort of is reminiscent of what I'm about to talk about, which is you don't actually own the battery, and you take a path where you are essentially doing what they did for global transport, and that is you make the Sealand band of batteries. So you make one battery shape, and every car uses the same shape, and you just pull into the refueling station. They replace the battery with a little robotic arm, and off you go. And so any other advances in battery technology, et cetera, can just fit into the same package.
You make it sound real easy. Let me go to Ethan Elkind.
Well, I think there's a challenge there. The automakers, for them, the battery is really their secret sauce, and there's a lot of compatibility issues. I don't think they want to develop that common form. I mean, I see this sort of ideal vision that you're talking about there, but the fact is the automakers don't want to get into that kind of sharing of the battery technology, even though it might produce some wins, but I think they like, you know, they don't even have the same format for charging when you get into fast charging. And actually, there was a comment I just wanted to make about that caller asked what the state's doing about charging infrastructure. The state is actually allowing utilities to invest pretty heavily now in electric vehicle infrastructure. And so as utilities start investing, they're sort of now going to be rivals with big oil. I mean, that was part of the idea, I think, with Sacramento, is that's big utilities versus big oil on fueling vehicles. And then on top of that, we've got a settlement with Volkswagen. If you know, listeners recall the big air emissions scandal, part of the settlement for that was that they would invest in EV charging. And also, dating back to the rolling blackouts in California about 15 years ago, part of the settlement out of that, through one of the subsidiary companies, that they have to invest about $100 million in electric vehicle charging. So there's a lot of different players in that space, but we haven't quite figured out how to get there in terms of the, you know, those fast charger destinations that that Joel was referring to, because we need a lot, you know, in along corridors like I-5, I-80, and it's coming also through state grants too. California Energy Commission is granting a lot for these chargers, but we do need more. We need to figure out a sort of sustainable way to deploy these chargers, because it's not a traditional gas station model, you know, where you can sell soda when you're charging, and that seems to, you know, given these gas station owners enough of a profit. So that's something actually that we're looking into at Berkeley Law, and we'll have a forthcoming report on.
And again, Ethan Elkind is with UC Berkeley School of Law. He directs the climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. Let me thank the caller, Dell, and go right to another caller from South City. Jan, you're on.
Yeah, one interesting I guess a topic I haven't heard too much about is the performance per dollar ratio. You know, if you have $100,000, the Tesla is fantastic. I mean, strong acceleration, range, and all of that. But a performance buyer like myself, I just don't see the attractiveness in the current electric vehicles besides the Tesla. I mean, I don't have like $100,000 to spend on a vehicle like that. So when I'm looking at a next vehicle to buy, I'm probably looking at a Lexus ISF V8. I mean, I get all the performance that I want, which is important for me for, you know, $40,000 versus, you know, $100,000 that I don't have. And, you know, just a final point, I mean, I have a American, you know, V8 Mustang that, you know, is fun to drive and it's reliable, but it's economical. I mean, I just don't see somebody like myself just going to electric because, like I said earlier, just that performance per cost gap is incredibly high.
Lauren McDonald, you're the evangelist.
Well, and I forget the caller's name, but wait 6 months and you will have the best car you have ever driven in your life, the Tesla Model 3. It will be faster than your Mustang or whatever, and it's going to be around $40,000. And so I say get down to a Tesla dealer, test drive a Model S, or, you know, test drive a Bolt or whatever it is, and you will be blown away. I've taken friends for a ride in my Tesla, and, you know, you see these videos where people are just, you know, sort of screaming with the speed of being pushed back into the seat. They are, you know, pound for pound, way more high performance than a V8 engine. And, yes, right now it's the high-end Teslas, but, you know, we're going to have $40,000 high-performance electric cars available in the next 6 to 9 months.
And I thank Jan for his call. We'll go by contrast to Sergio, who's also on talk about Tesla. Go ahead, Sergio.
Gentlemen, good morning. Yes, I am an old-fashioned guy. I want to hear the roar of a V8, but when I test drove the Model S, I was completely blown away. You know, I reserved my Model 3. I'm very excited. I can't wait. That's my comment about that. But I also had a question in regards to, you know, since all these regulations are lifted, wouldn't that raise the gas price in the future? And wouldn't that be better for electric cars? Wouldn't it be more better to purchase one of the electric cars instead of having a gas car?
Yeah, what do you think, Joel Levin?
Well, I think that gas prices, you know, one of the things about electricity is that price is very stable. Gas prices tend to jump around. I mean, the U.S. is a relatively small portion of the global market for gasoline, and so we're subject to all kinds of supply shocks when there's a war in some part of the world or we have a conflict with someone. So gas prices are very erratic and bounce around, and, you know, prices are pretty low right now, but I think you can expect that there will be a gas spike at some point and prices will jump up again and bounce around and then drop down. And with electricity, you don't really have that issue. As people start to shift over to electric cars en masse, I think that gas prices will come down. But again, electric prices are very stable and it's significantly cheaper than fueling a car and gasoline.
And I thank the caller, Sergio, and read a comment from Sage, who says, I got a great deal on used Leaf recently, but dealers were no help. I had to educate myself. They should do more to sell the cars. And going right to the heart of what you were saying before, Ethan Elkin, a question from Callie, who says, what efforts are in place to make electric car ownership more possible for urban dwellers without control over a garage space? Most of the efforts I've seen around infrastructure focus on placing chargers in public settings. It seems like the incentives for private garage owners to install any chargers are pretty poor. How do EV ownership become practical in cities?
Well, first of all, we may get to the point where for apartment dwellers, it's more likely that they'd want to charge at their workplace or that there might be by their local grocery store a fast charger. So with bigger batteries, maybe once a week, they just get a fast charge and that covers it and they don't necessarily even have to charge at home anymore. And with bigger batteries, that becomes possible. I think what we're likely to have to need to see is our third parties that are coming in with a business model to approach a landlord of a multifamily apartment building and say, look, I'll install this for you. I'll give you some revenue, and they can figure out a way to make money by basically maybe selling some of the charging or having batteries associated that provide grid services. So we're going to need some innovation in this space, but I do think as a range improves, people will find alternative ways to charge, even if they can't charge at home. But recognizing that home charging is probably the most convenient.
And here's a listener, Joe Levin, Mark, who says, I just bought a Bolt. I love it, but I was surprised at the high cost of my insurance premium. Any thoughts on why? Is there hope for cost reductions?
That's surprising to me, actually. I own a Nissan Leaf, and the insurance is about the same as it is for a gasoline car. I would imagine the insurance premium is high just because it's a new car. I think that from everything that I've seen, insurance is pretty much equivalent with gasoline cars. You know, not surprisingly, a Tesla costs more to insure than a lower cost car because it's more expensive, costs more to repair.
And there seems to be, Lauren McDonald, a little confusion about the cost of batteries. A listener named George says, one sentence, somebody said they dropped to 165 from 1,000. Another sentence, the battery in a Nissan Leaf contributed 20,000 to the car's price. Can we clarify battery costs here with you?
So the latest I've seen on the Bolt, that it's $145 per kilowatt hour. So if you do the math, I did it, I think, the other day, that would put it at over $8,000 for the cost of the battery on the Bolt. So that's the latest math that I'm aware of.
Yeah, it was actually my comment on those numbers. Yeah. And those are referring to the old contracts and the original Nissan Leaf battery, where I think they were getting more about $400 a kilowatt hour for the battery prices. So these are the brand new contracts now, down in the hundreds for the Bolt, and then you're going to see it with the Tesla Model 3.
Right, and they tend to be declining, like solar panels and stuff, you know, in that 10 to 20% per year.
And a question for you, Joel Levin, from a listener. What are some of the new EVs coming to market soon? I heard there was a minivan.
Yes, there is a minivan, the Chrysler Pacifica that is, they've just started production on it. It's supposed to be in dealers within the next month or so. So that's really important because that's a whole market segment that's currently empty. There is obviously the Bolt EV that has just come out. There's the new Tesla Model 3. Nissan is working on a vehicle that's supposedly in the 200-mile range as well, that's supposed to come out in the next year or so. There are a number of vehicles that are having their range extended, so the Volkswagen e-Golf is going to have a longer range with the 2017 that's supposed to be out any time now, and there's a number of others. It's an exciting time. There's quite a few vehicles that are coming out over the next 12 months.
What happened, Sean wants to know, in a tweet to the GM EV1, that was an electric car made and leased by General Motors during the late 90s. Do you know, Joel?
Well, yes, that is a sad story. So the EV1 was created in the late 90s in response to the California ZEV mandate that required the automakers to produce a certain number of electric vehicles. And then when that mandate, that law, was relaxed, the automakers decided to take the cars back. They basically were all leased and not sold. And it was, you know, quite a challenge for the automakers to get the cars out there, and they decided it wasn't worth it at the time. Now, I think things are very different. We now have more than 600,000 vehicles on the road in the United States. There's more than 30 models that are out there. There are, I believe, a number of the automakers that are very committed to putting the cars out there. They're a lot more serious. The technology has really changed from what it was back then. We've spent a lot of time talking about the battery technology. So I think the landscape is very different than it was 10, 15 years ago.
I'm going to go to another caller, Harvey from Berkeley, joining us. And Harvey is our regular caller who's been saying go solar for about over 20 years now. Harvey, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. And thank your wonderful guests for this show. There's a toy called slot cars, where little electric cars are powered by electric slots in the roadway, and because there are several solar electric roads being developed at this time, my idea is a road called the Sunway, and it's a highway that has a photovoltaic surface on the road as well as solar electric highway walls that power and charge the electric cars by inductions as it speeds along the Sunway.
What do you think, Ethan Elkind?
Well, I'm not much of a technology engineering person. I'm on the law and policy side. But, you know, if you can make it work, you know, see some demonstrations, some pilot projects, and, you know, you can go from there.
Harvey's always on the cutting edge, too, of solar technology. Thanks, Harvey, for that call. Let me get another caller on, and that's Jeremy. Good morning.
Good morning. First, I wanted to say hi to Ethan, who I went to high school with, I believe.
Oh, hey. Good to hear from you.
Hey. I wondered if there was two angles. One, namely, what can consumers/voters do to help policy? And is there any headway in, especially with drones being so popular and apparently payloads of weight for missiles and so forth can be carried. So I wondered, is there much future in consumer flight, electric, battery, or hydrogen, and maybe even some of us would select to pay a little bit more to save animal wildlife and so forth. But anything on the horizon?
Ethan Elkind.
Well, in terms of what consumers, you know, voters can do, certainly encouraging elected officials to, you know, keep up with the rebates, the mandates, the support for the industry. And we have a favorable climate here in California for that, so that's great. But, you know, if you care about the environment, you know, voting is important, but I would say getting an electric vehicle is one of the best purchases you could probably make to vote with your pocketbook. In terms of air travel, you know, what you're seeing right now is more, I think, about biofuels to reduce petroleum with air travel. It's, you know, some people think you could do batteries in airplanes. I'm sure there are some flying airplanes that are, you know, short distance, you know, crop duster kind of planes. I don't know when we're going to see them or if we're going to see them in big commercial flights. We may need alternative fuels like hydrogen, not to think of the Hindenburg kind of hydrogen, but hydrogen fuel cell type fueling or, you know, probably biofuels. And United just had a big contract for biofuels to mix into their fuel mix. So we're definitely seeing progress in that area, but not quite there yet, at least as far as I know.
United's going to need a whole different PR campaign, but we will get into that tomorrow. That passenger that was forced out. I want to get to a comment, though, by one of our listeners named Scott, who's pushing back on Tesla's popularity in Europe. We spoke about the figure 40% in the Netherlands and Holland of EV users. And this listener, Scott, says the uptake of Teslas in Holland is due to obscene government subsidies, such so that a Dutch businessman choosing a company car pays the same for a Tesla Model S as a VW Golf. Ethan?
Yeah, well, they have very favorable policies in some of these European countries where they have those tax policies. And, you know, we do have something along those lines with our tax credits, but the Europeans have been very very favorable in how they treat electric vehicles, clean technology in general. And I think it points to how the United States is going to become a laggard if, from the federal level, we start to put a pause on these programs, because we are going to get leapfrogged by countries in Europe, by places like China that are investing heavily and see a real way to make money in fighting climate change. They see that this is going to require huge technology shifts, electric vehicles being among the most prominent of those shifts, and that there's money to be made. California sees that too, but it remain to be seen whether or not the Trump administration sees that as well.
Let me go, Lauren McDonald, to you. A comment from Mary I'd like you to respond to. She says the potential lack of access to recharging stations when camping at a motel or staying with friends seems like a major obstacle for wide adoption, especially for families with only one car.
Yeah, I mean, the one-car situation I hear a lot. A lot of the early adopters will, have that backup SUV or whatever it is that will go 400 miles or whatever. But as we've talked, I mean, the destination charging situation is A, being taken care of by Tesla. If you own a Tesla, I drove up with my wife up the Mendocino Coast, 150 miles up there to Sea Ranch a couple months ago, and they had two Tesla chargers. They had another charger for other cars. So at one level, you know, sort of Tesla is taking care of that through these destination chargers. They actually provide the chargers for free. We were talking a few minutes ago about the apartment multifamily issue, and I think that's going to be sort of part of that solution. There's companies like ChargePoint, et cetera, who are doing that. They are providing the chargers to wineries, to apartment complexes, to businesses. And then the business has to actually then pay for the electricity and installation, but they're making sort of the charging free and sort of figuring out that business model. But you know, I think that one of the things we have to remember, though, is we're going to move from what we call range anxiety to charger anxiety. So when we get to the average car has 250 or 3 miles of range, then, you know, you can go just about anywhere in California, to Tahoe or whatever, except maybe to Disneyland, without needing a charge. But then you'll pull into that fast charger, that supercharger, and charge up in 10 or 15 minutes, and you'll be on your way.
And we're on our way to another caller. Janet, thank you for waiting. You're on.
Yes, my husband and I do farmers market, and the irony of taking a big V8 flatbed truck loaded with all our vegetables to, you know, what ostensibly is an environmentally good place hasn't been lost on me. And when we were first starting to drive to the market, I researched some vehicles and saw that in Europe they have plug-in hybrid diesel trucks for deliveries. Do you see any of that kind of vehicle being available in the near future?
Yeah, let me go to Joel Levin on this, Joel.
Well, the automakers all claim that they are working on that. The holy grail is that Ford, we hope someday, will put a plug on an F-150. There's rumors that they're working on that, so that would be a big change. One of the big issues with EVs, and we haven't really talked about that, is that when you look at the cars that people buy, there are, you know, many different types of buyers with different preferences and different needs and different lifestyles. And in the gasoline car market, there are, you know, many, many different market segments that fill all those requirements. And in the EV market right now, there's really just EV electric vehicles that fill pretty narrow range of market segments. I mean, mostly it's subcompact cars. So if you're looking for, you know, a big beefy pickup that can haul stuff, right now there isn't one on the market. And so there's a lot of work to be done to develop those different types of market segments that can meet different kinds of people's needs. And automakers are working on that. But those are a few years out still, but we expect that eventually those will all get filled in.
Well, we've come to the end of this most informative hour. I want to thank all our guests and actually conclude here with a comment from Will, who says, I'm pretty sure the next car I'll buy will be fully electric. Only question in my mind is if it will be self-driving or not. Thanks to Ethan Elkin from the UC Berkeley School of Law. Thank you, Ethan.
Thank you.
Thanks to Joel Levin, Plug in America. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you, Lauren McDonald. His forthcoming book, again, is Gas Station Zero. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.